lives that gum hasn't opened in years. Some of them are still occupied, so to speak, though the sounds from behind the doors peaked and trailed off to silence long ago. The levels of the floors vary from room to room by as much as a foot. There are thresholds to step over, lintels to duck. Loads are impossible to roll and difficult to drag. To march something ahead of you, it stumbling and crying, begging, banging its dazed head, is difficult, dangerous even. As he grew in wisdom and in confidence, Mr. Gum no longer felt he had to meet his needs in the hidden parts of the basement. He now uses a suite of basement rooms around the stairs, large rooms with running water and electricity. The basement is in total darkness now. Beneath the sand-floored room in the oubliette, Catherine Martin is quiet. Mr. Gum is here in the basement, but he is not in this chamber. The room beyond the stairs is black to human vision, but it is full of small sounds. Water trickles here, and small pumps hum. In little echoes the room sounds large. The air is moist and cool. Smell the greenery. A flutter of wings against the cheek, a few clicks across the air. A low nasal sound of pleasure, a human sound. The room has none of the wavelengths of light the human eye can use. But Mr. Gum is here, and he can see very well, though he sees everything in shades and intensities of green. He's wearing an excellent pair of infrared goggles, Israeli military surplus, less than $400, and he directs the beam of an infrared flashlight on the wire cage in front of him. He is sitting on the edge of a straight chair, wrapped, watching an insect climb a plant in the screen cage. The young imago has just emerged from a split chrysalis in the moist earth of the cage floor. She climbs carefully on a stalk of nightshade, seeking space to unfurl the damp new wings still wadded on her back. She selects a horizontal twig. Mr. Gum must tilt his head to see. Little by little, the wings are pumped full of blood and air. They are still stuck together over the insect's back. 2 hours pass. Mr. Gum has hardly moved. He turns the infrared flashlight on and off to surprise himself with the progress the insect has made. To pass the time, he plays the light over the rest of the room, over his big aquariums full of vegetable tanning solution. On forms and stretchers in the tanks, his recent acquisitions stand like broken classic statuary green beneath the sea. His light moves over the big galvanized work table with its metal pillow block and backsplash and drains, touches the hoist above it. Against the wall, his long industrial sinks, all in the green images of filtered infrared. Flutters, streaks of phosphorescence cross his vision, little comet trails of moths free in the room. He switches back to the cage just in time. The big insect's wings are held above her back, hiding and distorting her markings. Now she brings down her wings to cloak her body, and the famous design is clear. A human skull, wonderfully executed in the fur-like scales, stares from the back of the moth. Under the shaded dome of the skull are the black eye holes and prominent cheekbones. Beneath them darkness lies like a gag across the face above the jaw. The skull rests on a marking flared like the top of a pelvis. A skull stacked upon a pelvis, all drawn on the back of a moth by an accident of nature. Mr. Gum feels so good and light inside. He leans forward, puffs soft air across the moth. She raises her sharp proboscis and squeaks angrily. He walks quietly with his light into the oubliette room. He opens his mouth to quiet his breathing. He doesn't want to spoil his mood with a lot of noise from the pit. The lenses of his goggles on their small, protruding barrels look like crab eyes on stalks. Mr. Gum knows the goggles aren't the least bit attractive, but he has had some great times with them in the black basement, playing basement games. He leans over and shines his invisible light down the shaft. The material is lying on her side, curled like a shrimp. She seems to be asleep. Her waste bucket stands beside her. She has not foolishly broken the string again, trying to pull herself up the sheer walls. In her sleep, she clutches the corner of the futon against her face and sucks her thumb. Watching Catherine playing the infrared flashlight up and down her, Mr. Gum prepares himself for the very real problems ahead. The human skin is fiendishly difficult to deal with if your standards are as high as Mr. Gum's. There are fundamental structural decisions to make, and the first one is where to put the zipper. He moves the beam down Catherine's back. Normally he would put the closure in the back, but then how could he don it alone? It won't be the sort of thing he can ask someone to help him with, exciting as that prospect might be. He knows of places, circles, where his efforts would be much admired. There are certain yachts where he could preen, but that will have to wait. He must have things he can use alone. To split the center front would be sacrilege. He puts that right out of his mind. Mr. Gum can tell nothing of Catherine's color by infrared, but she looks thinner. He believes she may have been dieting when he took her. Experience has taught him to wait from 4 days to a week before harvesting the hide. Sudden weight loss makes the hide looser and easier to remove. In addition, starvation takes much of his subject's strength and makes them more manageable, more docile. A stuporous resignation comes over some of them. At the same time, it's necessary to provide a few rations to prevent despair and destructive tantrums that might damage the skin. It definitely has lost weight. This one is so special. So central to what he is doing, he can't stand to wait long, and he doesn't have to. Tomorrow afternoon he can do it, or tomorrow night. The next day at the latest. Soon. Chapter 34. Clarice Starling recognized the Stonehenge Villas sign from television news. The East Memphis housing complex, a mix of flats and townhouses, formed a large U around a parking field. Starling parked her rented Chevrolet Celebrity in the middle of the big lot. Well-paid blue-collar workers and bottom-echelon executives lived here. The Transams and IROC Z Camaros told her that. Motorhomes for the weekends and ski boats bright with glitter paint were parked in their own section of the lot. Stonehenge Villas, the spelling grated on Starling every time she looked at it. Probably the apartments were full of white wicker and peach shag, snapshots under the glass of the coffee table, the dinner for two cookbook and fondue on the menu. Starling, whose only residence was a dormitory room at the FBI Academy, was a severe critic of these things. She needed to know Catherine Baker Martin, and this seemed an odd place for a senator's daughter to live. Starling had read the brief biographical material the FBI had gathered, and it showed Catherine Martin to be a bright underachiever. She'd failed at Farmington and had 2 unhappy years at Middlebury. Now she was a student at Southwestern and a practice teacher. Starling could easily have pictured her as a self-absorbed, blunted boarding school kid, one of those people who never listen. Starling knew she had to be careful here because she had her own prejudices and resentments. Starling had done her time in boarding schools, living on scholarships, her grades much better than her clothes. She had seen a lot of kids from rich, troubled families with too much boarding school time. She didn't give a damn about some of them, but she had grown to learn that inattention can be a stratagem to avoid pain, and that it is often misread as shallowness and indifference. Better to think of Catherine as a child sailing with her father, as she was in the film they showed with Senator Martin's plea on television. She wondered if Catherine tried to please her father when she was little. She wondered what Catherine was doing when they came and told her that her father was dead of a heart attack at 42. Starling was positive Catherine missed him. Missing your father, the common wound, made Starling feel close to this young woman. Starling found it essential to like Catherine Martin because it helped her to bear down. Starling could see where Catherine's apartment was located. Two Tennessee Highway Patrol cruisers were parked in front of it. There were spots of white powder on the parking lot in the area closest to the apartment. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation must have been lifting oil stains with pumice or some other inert powder. Crawford said that TBI was pretty good. Starling walked over to the recreational vehicles and boats parked in the special section of the lot in front of the apartment. This is where Buffalo Bill got her. Close enough to her door so that she left it unlocked when she came out. Something tempted her out. It must have been a harmless-looking setup. Starling knew the Memphis police had done exhaustive door-to-door interviews, and nobody had seen anything. So maybe it happened among the tall motor homes. He must have watched from here. Sitting in some kind of vehicle, had to be. But Buffalo Bill knew Catherine was here. He must have spotted her somewhere and stalked her, waiting for his chance. Girls the size of Catherine aren't common. He didn't just sit around at random locations until a woman of the right size came by. He could sit for days and not see one. All the victims were big. All of them were big. Some were fat, but all were big. So he can get something that will fit. Remembering Dr. Lecter's words, Starling shuddered. Dr. Lecter, the new Memphian. Starling took a deep breath, puffed up her cheeks, and let the air out slowly. Let's see what we can tell about Catherine. A Tennessee state trooper wearing his Smokey the Bear hat answered the door of Catherine Martin's apartment. When Starling showed him her credentials, he motioned her inside. "Officer, I need to look over the premises here." Premises seemed a good word to use to a man who had his hat on in the house. He nodded. "If the phone rings, leave it alone. I'll answer it." On the counter in the open kitchen, Starling could see a tape recorder attached to the telephone. Beside it were two new telephones. One had no dial, a direct line to Southern Bell Security, the Mid-South tracing facility. "Can I help you anyway?" the young officer asked. "Are the police through in here?" "The apartment's been released to the family. I'm just here for the telephone. You can touch stuff if that's what you want to know." "Good, I'll look around then." "Okay." The young policeman retrieved the newspaper he had stuffed beneath the couch and resumed his seat. Starling wanted to concentrate. She wished she were alone in the apartment, but she knew she was lucky the place wasn't full of cops. She started in the kitchen. It was not equipped by a serious cook. Catherine had come for popcorn, the boyfriend had told police. Starling opened the freezer. There were two boxes of microwave popcorn. You couldn't see the parking lot from the kitchen. "Where are you from?" Starling didn't register the question the first time. "Where are you from?" The trooper on the couch was watching her over his newspaper. "Washington," she said. Under the sink... Yep, scratches on the pipe joint. They'd taken the trap out and examined it. Good for the TBI. The knives were not sharp. The dishwasher had been run but not emptied. The refrigerator was devoted to cottage cheese and deli fruit salad. Catherine Martin shopped for fast food groceries, probably had a regular place, a drive-in she used close by. Maybe somebody cruised the store. That's worth checking.
"You with the Attorney General?"
"No, the FBI.
"The Attorney General's coming. That's what I heard it turn out. How long you been in the FBI?
There was a rubber cabbage in the vegetable drawer. Starling rolled it over and checked the jewelry compartment inside.
empty. "How long you been in the FBI?"
Starling looked at the young policeman.
"Officer, tell you what, I'll probably need to ask you a couple things after I finish looking around here. Maybe you could help me out then."
"Sure, if I can."
"Good, okay. Let's wait and talk then. I have to think about this right now."
"Well, no problem there."
The bedroom was bright, with a sunny, drowsy quality Starling liked. It was done with better fabrics and better furnishings than most young women could afford. There was a Coromandel screen, two pieces of cloisonné on the shelves, and a good secretary in burled walnut. Twin beds. Starling lifted the edge of the coverlets. Rollers were locked on the left bed, but not on the right-hand one. Catherine must push them together when it suits her. May have a lover the boyfriend doesn't know about. Or maybe they stay over here sometimes. There's no remote beeper on her answering machine. She may need to be here when her mom calls. The answering machine was like her own, the basic phone mate. She opened the top panel. Both incoming and outgoing tapes were gone. In their place was a note, tapes TBI property number 6. The room was reasonably neat, but it had the ruffled appearance left by searchers with big hands, men who try to put things back exactly but miss just a little bit. Starling would have known the place had been searched even without the traces of fingerprint powder on all the smooth surfaces. Starling didn't believe that any part of the crime had happened in the bedroom. Crawford probably was right. Catherine had been grabbed in the parking lot. But Starling wanted to know her, and this is where she lived. Lives, Starling corrected herself. She lives here. In the cabinet of the nightstand were a telephone book, Kleenex, a box of grooming items, and behind the box a Polaroid SX-70 camera with a cable release and a short tripod folded beside it. Intent as a lizard, Starling looked at the camera. She blinked as a lizard blinks and didn't touch it. The closet interested Starling most. Catherine Baker Martin, laundry mark CBM, had a lot of clothes, and some of them were very good. Starling recognized many of the labels, including Garfinkel's and Britches in Washington. "Presents from Mommy," Starling said to herself. Catherine had fine, classic clothes in two sizes, made to fit her at about 145 and 165 pounds, Starling guessed, and there were a few pairs of crisis fat pants and pullovers from the statuesque shop. In a hanging rack were 23 pairs of shoes. 7 pairs were Ferragamos in 10C, and there were some Reeboks and Runover loafers. A light backpack and a tennis racket were on the top shelf. The belongings of a privileged kid, a student, and practice teacher who lived better than most. Lots of letters in the secretary. Loopy backhand notes from former classmates in the East, stamps, mailing labels, gift wrapping paper in the bottom drawer, a sheaf in various colors and patterns. Starling's fingers walked through it. She was thinking about questioning the clerks at the local drive-in market when her fingers found a sheet in the stack of gift wrap that was too thick and stiff. Her fingers went past it, walked back to it. She was trained to register anomalies, and she had it half pulled out when she looked at it. The sheet was blue, of a material similar to a lightweight blotter, and the pattern printed on it was a crude imitation of the cartoon dog Pluto. The little rows of dogs all looked like Pluto. They were the proper yellow, but they weren't exactly right in their proportions. "Catherine, Catherine," Starling said. She took some tweezers from her bag and used them to slide the sheet of colored paper into a plastic envelope. She placed it on the bed for the time being. The jewelry box on the dresser was a stamped leather affair, the kind you see in every girl's dormitory room. The two drawers in front and the tiered lid contained costume jewelry, no valuable pieces. Starling wondered if the best things had been in the rubber cabbage in the refrigerator, and if so, who took them. She hooked her finger under the side of the lid and released the secret drawer in the back of the jewelry box. The secret drawer was empty. She wondered whom these drawers were a secret from, certainly not burglars. She was reaching behind the jewelry box, pushing the drawer back in, when her fingers touched the envelope taped to the underside of the secret drawer. Starling pulled on a pair of cotton gloves and turned the jewelry box around. She took out the empty drawer and inverted it. A brown envelope was taped to the bottom of the drawer with masking tape. The flap was just tucked in, not sealed. She held the paper close to her nose. The envelope had not been fumed for fingerprints. Starling used the tweezers to open it and extract the contents. There were 5 Polaroid pictures in the envelope, and she took them out, one by one. The pictures were of a man and woman coupling. No heads or faces appeared. 2 of the pictures were taken by the woman, 2 by the man, and 1 appeared to have been shot from the tripod set up on the nightstand. It was hard to judge scale in a photograph, but with that spectacular 145 pounds on a long frame, the woman had to be Catherine Martin. The man wore what appeared to be a carved ivory ring on his penis. The resolution of the photograph was not sharp enough to reveal the details of it. The man had had his appendix out. Starling bagged the photographs, each in a sandwich bag, and put them in her own brown envelope. She returned the drawer to the jewelry box. "I have the good stuff in my pocketbook," said a voice behind her. "I don't think anything was taken." Starling looked in the mirror. Senator Ruth Martin stood in the bedroom door. She looked drained. Starling turned around. "Hello, Senator Martin. Would you like to lie down? I'm almost finished." Even exhausted, Senator Martin had a lot of presence. Under her careful finish, Starling saw a scrapper. "Who are you, please? I thought the police were through in here." "I'm Clarice Starling, FBI. Did you talk to Dr. Lecter, Senator?" "He gave me a name." Senator Martin lit a cigarette and looked Starling up and down. "We'll see what it's worth." "And what did you find in the jewelry box, Officer Starling? What's it worth?" "Some documentation we can check out in just a few minutes," was the best Starling could do. "In my daughter's jewelry box? Let's see it." Starling heard voices in the next room and hoped for an interruption. "Is Mr. Copley with you, the Memphis special agent in—" "No, he's not, and that's not an answer. No offense, officer, but I'll see what you got out of my daughter's jewelry box." She turned her head and called over her shoulder, "Paul, Paul, would you come in here? Officer Starling, you may know Mr. Krendler from the Department of Justice. Paul, this is the girl Jack Crawford sent in to Lecter." Krendler's bald spot was tanned, and he looked fit at 40. "Mr. Krendler, I know who you are. Hello," Starling said. "DJ, Criminal Division, Congressional Liaison, Troubleshooter, at least an Assistant Deputy Attorney General. Jesus, God save my bod. Officer Starling found something in my daughter's jewelry box, and she put it in her brown envelope. I think we'd better see what it is, don't you?"
"Officer," Krendler said.
"May I speak to you, Mr. Krendler?"
"Of course you can.
Later." He held out his hand. Starling's face was hot. She knew Senator Martin was not herself, but she would never forgive Krendler for the doubt in his face. Never.
"You got it,"
Starling said. She handed him the envelope. Krendler looked in at the first picture and had closed the flap again when Senator Martin took the envelope out of his hands. It was painful to watch her examine the pictures. When she finished, she went to the window and stood with her face turned up to the overcast sky, her eyes closed. She looked old in the daylight, and her hand trembled when she tried to smoke.
"Senator, I—" Krendler began.
"The police searched this room," Senator Martin said. "I'm sure they found those pictures and had sense enough to put them back and keep their mouths shut."
"No, they did not," Starling said.
The woman was wounded, but hell. "Mrs. Martin, we need to know who this man is. You can see that. If it's the boyfriend, fine. I can find that out in 5 minutes. Nobody else needs to see the pictures, and Catherine never needs to know."
"I'll tend to it."
Senator Martin put the envelope in her purse, and Krendler let her do it.
"Senator, did you take the jewelry out of the rubber cabbage in the kitchen?" Starling asked.
Senator Martin's aide, Brian Gossage, stuck his head in the door.
Excuse me, Senator, they got the terminal set up. We can watch them search the William Rubin name at the FBI.
Go ahead, Senator Martin, Crindler said. I'll be out in a second. Ruth Martin left the room without answering Starling's question.
Starling had a chance to look Crindler over as he was closing the bedroom door. His suit was a triumph of single-needle tailoring, and he was not armed. The shine was buffed off the bottom half-inch of his heels from walking on much deep carpet, and the edges of the heels were sharp. He stood for a moment with his hand on the doorknob, his head down.
"That was a good search," he said when he turned around. Starling couldn't be had that cheap. She looked back at him.
"They turn out good rummagers at Quantico," Crindler said.
"They don't turn out thieves."
"I know that," he said. "Hard to tell."
"Drop it."
"We'll follow up on the pictures and the rubber cabbage, right?" she said.
"Yes."
"What's the William Rubin name, Mr. Crindler?"
"Lecter says that's Buffalo Bill's name. Here's our transmission to ID section and NCIC. Look at this."
He gave her a transcript of the Lecter interview with Senator Martin, blurry copy from a dot matrix printer.
"Any thoughts?" he said when she finished reading.
"There's nothing here he'll ever have to eat," Starling said. "He says it's a white male named Billy Rubin who had elephant ivory anthrax. You couldn't catch him in a lie here, no matter what happens. At the worst, he'd just be mistaken.
I hope this is true.
But he could be having fun with her, Mr. Crindler. He's perfectly capable of that. Have you ever met him?"
Crindler shook his head and snorted air from his nose.
"Dr. Lecter killed 9 people we know of. He's not walking, no matter. He could raise the dead, and they wouldn't let him out. So all that's left for him is fun. That's why we were playing him."
"I know how you were playing him. I heard Chilton's tape. I'm not saying it was wrong. I'm saying it's over. Behavioral science can follow up what you got, the transsexual angle, for what it's worth. And you'll be back in school at Quantico tomorrow."
"Oh, boy."
"I found something else." The sheet of colored paper had lain on the bed unnoticed. She gave it to him.
"What is it?"
"Looks like a sheet of Pluto's." She made him ask the rest. He beckoned for the information with his hand.
"I'm pretty sure it's blotter acid, LSD, from maybe the middle 70s or before. It's a curiosity now. It's worth finding out where she got it. We should test it to be sure."
"You can take it back to Washington and give it to the lab. You'll be going in a few minutes."
"If you don't want to wait, we can do it now with a field kit. If the police have got a standard narcotics identification kit, it's test J. Take 2 seconds. We can..."
"Back to Washington, back to school," he said, opening the door.
"Mr. Crawford instructed me..."
"Your instructions are what I'm telling you. You're not under Jack Crawford's direction now. You're back under the same supervision as any other trainee forthwith, and your business is at Quantico. Do you understand me? There's a plane at 2:10. Be on it."
"Mr. Crindler, Dr. Lecter talked to me after he refused to talk to the Baltimore police. He might do that again."
Mr. Crawford thought Crindler closed the door again, harder than he had to.
"Officer Starling, I don't have to explain myself to you, but listen to me. Behavioral science's brief is advisory, always has been. It's going back to that. Jack Crawford should be on compassionate leave anyway. I'm surprised he's been able to perform as well as he has. He took a foolish chance with this, keeping it from Senator Martin, and he got his butt sawed off. With his record this close to retirement, even she can't hurt him that much. So I wouldn't worry about his pension if I were you."
Starling lost it a little. "You've got somebody else who's caught 3 serial murderers? You know anybody else who's caught 1? You shouldn't let her run this, Mr. Crindler."
"You must be a bright kid, or Crawford wouldn't bother with you, so I'll tell you 1 time. Do something about that mouth, or it'll put you in the typing pool. Don't you understand the only reason you were ever sent to Lecter in the first place was to get some news for your director to use on Capitol Hill? Harmless stuff on major crimes, the inside scoop on Dr. Lecter. He hands that stuff out like pocket candy while he's trying to get the budget through. Congressmen eat it up. They dine out on it. You're out of line, Officer Starling, and you're out of this case. I know you got supplementary ID. Let's have it."
"I need the ID to fly with the gun. The gun belongs at Quantico."
gun. Jesus, turn in the ID as soon as you get back.
Senator Martin, Gossage, a technician, and several policemen were gathered around a video display terminal with a modem connected to the telephone. The National Crime Information Center's hotline kept a running account of progress as Dr. Lecter's information was processed in Washington. Here was news from the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Elephant ivory anthrax is contracted by breathing dust from grinding African ivory, usually for decorative handles. In the United States, it is a disease of knife makers. At the word knife makers, Senator Martin closed her eyes. They were hot and dry. She squeezed the Kleenex in her hand. The young trooper who had let Starling into the apartment was bringing the senator a cup of coffee. He still had on his hat. Starling was damned if she'd slink out. She stopped before the woman and said, "Good luck, Senator. I hope Catherine's all right." Senator Martin nodded without looking at her. Krendler urged Starling out.
"I didn't know she wasn't supposed to be in here," the young trooper said as she left the room.
Krendler stepped outside with her.
"I have nothing but respect for Jack Crawford," he said. "Please tell him how sorry we all are about Bella's problem, all that. Now let's get back to school and get busy, all right?"
"Goodbye, Mr. Krendler." Then she was alone on the parking lot, with the unsteady feeling that she understood nothing at all in this world. She watched a pigeon walk around beneath the motorhomes and boats. It picked up a peanut hull and put it back down. A damp wind ruffled its feathers. Starling wished she could talk to Crawford. "Waste and stupidity get you the worst," that's what he said. "Use this time and it'll temper you. Now's the hardest test, not letting rage and frustration keep you from thinking. It's the core of whether you can command or not." She didn't give a damn about commanding. She found she didn't give a damn, or a shit for that matter, about being Special Agent Starling, not if you play this way. She thought about the poor, fat, sad, dead girl she saw on the table in the funeral home at Potter, West Virginia. Painted her nails with glitter, just like these goddamned redneck ski boats. What was her name? Kimberly. "Damn if these assholes are going to see me cry." Jesus, everybody was named Kimberly, four in her class. Three guys named Sean. Kimberly, with her soap opera name, tried to fix herself, punched all those holes in her ears, trying to look pretty, trying to decorate herself. And Buffalo Bill looked at her sad, flat tits and stuck the muzzle of a gun between them and blew a starfish in her chest. Kimberly, her sad, fat sister who waxed her legs. No wonder, judging from her face and her arms and legs, her skin was her best feature. "Kimberly, are you angry somewhere?" No senators looking out for her. No jets to carry crazy men around. Crazy was a word she wasn't supposed to use. Lots of stuff she wasn't supposed to do. Crazy men. Starling looked at her watch. She had an hour and a half before the plane, and there was one small thing she could do. She wanted to look in Dr. Lecter's face when he said, "Billy Rubin." If she could stand to meet those strange maroon eyes for long enough, if she looked deeply where the dark sucks in the sparks, she might see something useful. She thought she might see glee. "Thank God I've still got the ID." She laid 12 feet of rubber, pulling out of the parking lot. Chapter 35. Clarice Starling driving in a hurry through the perilous Memphis traffic, 2 tears of anger dried stiff on her cheeks. She felt oddly floaty and free now. An unnatural clarity in her vision warned her that she was inclined to fight, so she was careful of herself. She had passed the old courthouse earlier on her way from the airport, and she found it again without trouble. The Tennessee authorities were taking no chances with Hannibal Lecter. They were determined to hold him securely without exposing him to the dangers of the city jail.
Their answer was the former courthouse and jail, a massive Gothic-style structure built of granite back when labor was free. It was a city office building now, somewhat over-restored in this prosperous, history-conscious town. Today it looked like a medieval stronghold surrounded by police. A mix of law enforcement cruisers, highway patrol, Shelby County Sheriff's Department, Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, and Department of Corrections crowded the parking lot. There was a police post to pass before Starling could even get in to park her rented car. Dr. Lecter presented an additional security problem from outside. Threatening calls had been coming in ever since the mid-morning newscast reported his whereabouts. His victims had many friends and relatives who would love to see him dead. Starling hoped the resident FBI agent Copley wasn't here. She didn't want to get him in trouble. She saw the back of Chilton's head in a knot of reporters on the grass beside the main steps. There were two television minicams in the crowd. Starling wished her head were covered. She turned her face away as she approached the entrance to the tower. A state trooper stationed in front of the door examined her ID card before she could go into the foyer. The foyer of the tower looked like a guard room now. A city policeman was stationed at the single tower elevator and another at the stairs. State troopers, the relief for the patrol unit stationed around the building, read the commercial appeal on the couches where the public could not see them. A sergeant manned the desk opposite the elevator. His name tag said Tate, C.L. "No press," Sergeant Tate said when he saw Starling. "No," she said. "You with the Attorney General's people?" he said when he looked at her card. "Deputy Assistant Attorney General Krendler," she said. "I just left him." He nodded. "We've had every kind of cop in West Tennessee in here wanting to look at Dr. Lecter. Don't see something like that very often, thank God. You need to talk to Dr. Chilton before we go up." "I saw him outside," Starling said. "We were working on this in Baltimore earlier today. Is this where I log in, Sergeant Tate?" The sergeant briefly checked a molar with his tongue. "Right there," he said. "Detention rules, miss. Visitors check weapons, cops or not." Starling nodded. She dumped the cartridges from her revolver, the sergeant glad to watch her hands move on the gun. She gave it to him butt first, and he locked it in his drawer. "Vernon, take her up." He dialed three digits and spoke her name into the phone. The elevator, an addition from the 1920s, creaked up to the top floor. It opened onto a stair landing and a short corridor. "Right straight across, ma'am," the trooper said. Painted on the frosted glass of the door was Shelby County Historical Society. Almost all the top floor of the tower was one octagonal room painted white, with a floor and moldings of polished oak. It smelled of wax and library paste. With its few furnishings, the room had a spare, congregational feeling. It looked better now than it ever had as a bailiff's office. Two men in the uniform of the Tennessee Department of Corrections were on duty. The small one stood up at his desk when Starling came in. The bigger one sat in a folding chair at the far end of the room, facing the door of the cell. He was the suicide watch. "You're authorized to talk with the prisoner, ma'am," the officer at the desk said. His nameplate read Pembry, T.W., and his desk set included a telephone, two riot batons, and chemical mace. A long pinion stood in the corner behind him. "Yes, I am," Starling said. "I've questioned him before." "You know the rules. Don't pass the barrier." "Absolutely." The only color in the room was the police traffic barrier, a brightly striped sawhorse in orange and yellow, mounted with round yellow flashers, now turned off. It stood on the polished floor 5 feet in front of the cell door. On a coat tree nearby hung the doctor's things, the hockey mask, and something Starling had never seen before, a Kansas gallows vest. Made of heavy leather with double-locking wrist shackles at the waist and buckles in the back, it may be the most infallible restraint garment in the world. The mask and the black vest, suspended by its nape from the coat tree, made a disturbing composition against the white wall. Starling could see Dr. Lecter as she approached the cell. He was reading at a small table bolted to the floor. His back was to the door. He had a number of books, and the copy of the running file on Buffalo Bill she had given him in Baltimore. A small cassette player was chained to the table leg. How strange to see him outside the asylum. Starling had seen cells like this before as a child. They were prefabricated by a St. Louis company around the turn of the century, and no one has ever built them better. A tempered steel modular cage that turns any room into a cell. The floor was sheet steel laid over bars, and the walls and ceiling of cold-forged bars completely lined the room. There was no window. The cell was spotlessly white and brightly lit. A flimsy paper screen stood in front of the toilet. These white bars ribbed the walls. Dr. Lecter had a sleek, dark head. He's a cemetery mink. He lives down in a rib cage in the dry leaves of a heart. She blinked it away. "Good morning, Clarice," he said without turning around. He finished his page, marked his place, and spun in his chair to face her, his forearms on the chair back, his chin resting on them. "Dumas tells us that the addition of a crow to bouillon in the fall, when the crow has fattened on juniper berries, greatly improves the color and flavor of stock. How do you like it in the soup, Clarice?"
"I thought you might want your drawings, the stuff from your cell, just until you get your view."
"How thoughtful. Dr. Chilton's euphoric about you and Jack Crawford being put off the case, or did they send you in for one last wheedle?"
The officer on suicide watch had strolled back to talk to Officer Pembry at the desk. Starling hoped they couldn't hear.
"They didn't send me, I just came."
"People will say we're in love." "Don't you want to ask about Billy Rubin, Clarice?"
"Dr. Lecter, without in any way impugning what you've told Senator Martin, would you advise me to go on with your idea about..."
"Impugning. I love it. I wouldn't advise you at all. You tried to fool me, Clarice. Do you think I'm playing with these people?"
"I think you were telling me the truth."
"Pity you tried to fool me, isn't it?"
Dr. Lecter's face sank behind his arms until only his eyes were visible.
"Pity Catherine Martin won't ever see the sun again. The sun's a mattress fire her god died in, Clarice.
Pity you have to pander now and lick a few tears when you can," Starling said. "It's a pity we didn't get to finish what we were talking about. Your idea of the imago, the structure of it, had a kind of elegance that's hard to get away from. Now it's like a ruin, half an arch standing there."
"Half an arch won't stand. Speaking of arches, will they still let you pound a beat, Clarice? Did they take your badge?"
"No."
"What's that under your jacket, a watchman's clock just like Dad's?"
"No, that's a speed loader."
"So you go around armed?"
"Yes."
"Then you should let your jacket out. Do you sew at all?"
"Yes."
"Did you make that costume?"
"No."
"Dr. Lecter, you find out everything. You couldn't have talked intimately with this Billy Rubin and come out knowing so little about him."
"You think not?"
"If you met him, you know everything. But today you happen to remember just one detail. He'd had elephant ivory anthrax. You should have seen them jump when Atlanta said it's a disease of knife-makers. They ate it up just like you knew they would. You should have gotten a suite at the Peabody for that. Dr. Lecter, if you met him, you know about him. I think maybe you didn't meet him and Raspail told you about him. Second-hand stuff wouldn't sell as well to Senator Martin, would it?"
Starling took a quick look over her shoulder. One of the officers was showing the other something in Guns and Ammo magazine.
"You had more to tell me in Baltimore, Dr. Lecter. I believe that stuff was valid. Tell me the rest."
"I've read the cases, Clarice. Have you?" Everything you need to know to find him is right there, if you're paying attention. Even Inspector Emeritus Crawford should have figured it out. Incidentally, did you read Crawford's stupefying speech last year to the National Police Academy? Spouting Marcus Aurelius on duty and honor and fortitude, we'll see what kind of a stoic Crawford is when Bella bites the big one. He copies his philosophy out of Bartlett's Familiar, I think. If he understood Marcus Aurelius, he might solve his case. Tell me how. When you show the odd flash of contextual intelligence, I forget your generation can't read, Clarice. The Emperor counsels simplicity. First, principles. Of each particular thing, ask, what is it in itself, in its own constitution? What is its causal nature? That doesn't mean anything to me. What does he do, the man you want? He kills... Ah! He said sharply, averting his face for a moment from her wrong-headedness. That's incidental. What is the first and principal thing he does? What need does he serve by killing? Anger? Social resentment? Sexual frustration? No! What then? He covets. In fact, he covets being the very thing you are. It's his nature to covet. How do we begin to covet, Clarice? Do we seek out things to covet? Make an effort at an answer. No. We just know, precisely so. We begin by coveting what we see every day. Don't you feel eyes moving over you every day, Clarice, in chance encounters? I hardly see how you could not. And don't your eyes move over things? All right. Then tell me how. It's your turn to tell me, Clarice. You don't have any beach vacations at the hoof and mouth disease station to offer me anymore. It's strictly quid pro quo from here on out. I have to be careful doing business with you. Tell me, Clarice. Tell you what? The two things you owe me from before. What happened to you and the horse? And what do you do with your anger? Dr. Lecter, when there's time, we don't reckon time the same way, Clarice. This is all the time you'll ever have. Later, listen, I'll listen now. 2 years after your father's death, your mother sent you to live with her cousin and her husband on a ranch in Montana. You were 10 years old. You discovered they fed out slaughter horses. You ran away with a horse that couldn't see very well. And it was summer. And we could sleep out. We got as far as Bozeman by a back road. Did the horse have a name? Probably, but you don't find that out when you're feeding out slaughter horses. I called her Hannah. That seemed like a good name. Were you leading her or riding? Some of both. I had to lead her up beside a fence to climb on. You rode and walked to Bozeman. There was a liveried stable dude ranch riding academy sort of thing just outside of town. I tried to see about them keeping her. It was $20 a week in the corral, more for a stall. They could tell right off she couldn't see. I said, okay, I'll lead her around. Little kids can sit on her, and I'll lead her around while their parents are, you know, regular riding. I can stay right here and muck out stalls. One of them, the man, agreed to everything I said while his wife called the sheriff. The sheriff was a policeman, like your father. That didn't keep me from being scared of him at first. He had a big red face.
The sheriff finally put up $20 for the week's board while he straightened things out. He said there was no use going for the stall in warm weather. The papers picked it up. There was a flap. My mother's cousin agreed to let me go. I wound up going to the Lutheran home in Bozeman.
It's an orphanage.
Yes.
And Hannah?
She went too. A big Lutheran rancher put up the hay. They already had a barn at the orphanage. We plowed the garden with her. You had to watch where she was going, though. She'd walk through the butterbean trellises and step on any kind of plant that was too short for her to feel it against her legs. And we led her around pulling kids in a cart.
She died, though.
Well, yes.
Tell me about that.
It was last year, they wrote me at school. They think she was about 22. Pulled a cart full of kids the last day she lived and died in her sleep.
Dr. Lecter seemed disappointed. How heartwarming, he said. Did your foster father in Montana fuck you, Clarice?
No.
Did he try?
No.
What made you run away with the horse?
They were going to kill her.
Did you know when?
Not exactly. I worried about it all the time. She was getting pretty fat.
What triggered you then? What set you off on that particular day?
I don't know.
I think you do.
I had worried about it all the time.
What set you off, Clarice? You started what time?
Early, still dark.
Then something woke you. What woke you up? Did you dream? What was it?
I woke up and heard the lambs screaming. I woke up in the dark and the lambs were screaming.
They were slaughtering the spring lambs?
Yes.
What did you do?
I couldn't do anything for them. I was just a...
What did you do with the horse?
I got dressed without turning on the light and went outside. She was scared. All the horses in the pen were scared and milling around. I blew in her nose and she knew it was me. Finally, she'd put her nose in my hand. The lights were on in the barn and in the shed by the sheep pen. Bare bulbs, big shadows. The refrigerator truck had come and it was idling, roaring. I led her away.
Did you saddle her?
No, I didn't take their saddle, just a rope hackamore was all.
As you went off in the dark, could you hear the lambs back where the lights were?
Not long. There weren't but 12.
You still wake up sometimes, don't you? Wake up in the iron dark with a lamb screaming.
Sometimes.
Do you think if you caught Buffalo Bill yourself, and if you made Catherine all right, you could make the lamb stop screaming? Do you think they'd be all right, too, and you wouldn't wake up again in the dark and hear the lamb screaming, Clarice?
Yes. I don't know. Maybe.
Thank you, Clarice.
Dr. Lecter seemed oddly at peace.
Tell me his name, Dr. Lecter, Starling said.
Dr. Chilton, Lecter said. I believe you know each other. For an instant, Starling didn't realize Chilton was behind her. Then he took her elbow.
She took it back. Officer Pembry and his big partner were with Chilton.
In the elevator, Chilton said.
His face was mottled red.
Did you know Dr. Chilton has no medical degree? Dr. Lecter said. Please bear that in mind later on.
Let's go, Chilton said.
You're not in charge here, Dr. Chilton, Starling said. Officer Pembry came around Chilton.
No, ma'am, but I am. He called my boss and your boss both. I'm sorry, but I've got orders to see you out. Come on with me now. Goodbye, Clarice. Will you let me know if ever the lamb stops screaming?
Yes. Pembry was taking her arm. It was go or fight him.
Yes, she said, I'll tell you. Do you promise?
Yes.
Then why not finish the arch? Take your case file with you, Clarice. I won't need it any more. He held it at arm's length through the bars, his forefinger along the spine. She reached across the barrier and took it. For an instant the tip of her forefinger touched Dr. Lecter's. The touch crackled in his eyes. Thank you, Clarice.
Thank you, Dr. Lecter.
And that is how he remained in Starling's mind. Caught in the instant when he did not mock. Standing in his white cell, arched like a dancer, his hands clasped in front of him and his head slightly to the side. She went over a speed bump at the airport fast enough to bang her head on the roof of the car and had to run for the airplane Krendler had ordered her to catch.
Chapter 36 Officers Pembry and Boyle were experienced men, brought especially from Brushy Mountain State Prison to be Dr. Lecter's warders. They were calm and careful, and did not feel they needed their job explained to them by Dr. Chilton. They had arrived in Memphis ahead of Lecter and examined the cell minutely. When Dr. Lecter was brought to the old courthouse, they examined him as well. He was subjected to an internal body search by a male nurse while he was still in restraints. His clothing was searched thoroughly and a metal detector run over the seams. Boyle and Pembry came to an understanding with him, speaking in low, civil tones close to his ears as he was examined. Dr. Lecter, we can get along just fine. We'll treat you just as good as you treat us. Act like a gentleman and you get the Eskimo pie. But we're not pussyfooting around with you, buddy. Try to bite, and we'll leave you smooth-mouthed. Looks like you got something good going here. You don't want to fuck it up, do you? Dr. Lecter crinkled his eyes at them in a friendly fashion. If he had been inclined to reply, he would have been prevented by the wooden peg between his molars as the nurse shined a flashlight in his mouth and ran a gloved finger into his cheeks. The metal detector beeped at his cheeks.
What's that? The nurse asked.
Fillings, Pembry said. Pull his lip back there. You put some miles on them back ones, haven't you, Doc?
Strikes me he's pretty much of a broke dick, Boyle confided to Pembry after they had Dr. Lecter secure in his cell. He won't be no trouble if he don't flip out.
The cell, while secure and strong, lacked a rolling food carrier. At lunchtime, in the unpleasant atmosphere that followed Starling's visit, Dr. Chilton inconvenienced everyone, making Boyle and Pembry go through the long process of securing the compliant Dr. Lecter in the straitjacket and leg restraints as he stood with his back to the bars, Chilton poised with the mace, before they opened the door to carry in his tray. Chilton refused to use Boyle's and Pembry's names, though they wore nameplates, and addressed them indiscriminately as, "You there." For their part, after the warders heard Chilton was not a real M.D., Boyle observed to Pembry that he was just some kind of goddamn schoolteacher. Pembry tried once to explain to Chilton that Starling's visit had been approved not by them, but by the desk downstairs, and saw that in Chilton's anger it didn't matter. Dr. Chilton was absent at supper. And with Dr. Lecter's bemused cooperation, Boyle and Pembry used their own method to take in his tray. It worked very well. "Dr. Lecter, you're not going to be needing your dinner jacket tonight," Pembry said. "I'll ask you to sit on the floor and scoot backwards till you can just stick your hands out through the bars, arms extended backward. There you go. Scoot up a little and straighten them out more behind you, elbows straight." Pembry handcuffed Dr. Lecter tightly outside the bars, with a bar between his arms and a low crossbar above them. "That hurts just a little bit, don't it? I know it does, and they won't be on there but a minute. Save us both a lot of trouble." Dr. Lecter could not rise, even to a squat, and with his legs straight in front of him on the floor, he couldn't kick. Only when Dr. Lecter was pinioned did Pembry return to the desk for the key to the cell door. Pembry slid his riot baton and the ring at his waist,
put a canister of mace in his pocket, and returned to the cell. He opened the door while Boyle took in the tray. When the door was secured, Pembry took the key back to the desk before he took the cuffs off Dr. Lecter. At no time was he near the bars with the key while the doctor was free in the cell.
"Now that was pretty easy, wasn't it?" Pembry said.
"It was very convenient, thank you, officer," Dr. Lecter said.